This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters series.
I'm so excited. I just sent my manuscript to Jacinta and Danielle.
What do you mean? I think it's like just this moment.
Well, like half an hour ago.
Yes.
Yeah. So which, and I think it's ready to go, like as in ready to go out. So refresh my email. I've already refreshed my email like 50 times.
Obviously, because let's remember what we are internally wishing for, which is that they both call you. Don't check the email. What you want is your phone going off, simultaneous phone calls saying it's the best thing we've ever read. We've already got a movie deal, right? Bye tonight.
Oh, my God. We're so transparent, aren't we?
We really are. That's why we do this podcast, to show our vulnerability. Tell me, did you finish? How did it go finish reading it with the kids?
That was great. It was such a valuable exercise. It sort of made me cringe that I hadn't done that previously, you know, but that's okay. Live and learn. That's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were great. They were really good. Oscar was very, very positive. He ended up making this, he stapled a few pages together and he wrote on the front, the Book of Good Books. And so then yes. He did a picture of Harry Potter made the cut, R.A. Sprat made the cut, Mark Smith made the cut because we had met him at an event. And
so he's a real live author.
Well, we had met him at an event and I said to the kids, oh, he's really good. He wrote this trilogy series. And so Oscar kept coming in and saying, what was the name of Mark Smith? So they're in the book and then my books are in the Book of Good Books. It's very sweet.
That is so good. And obviously something that you should keep and hold on to for content.
I just thinking
more
about
than
that,
anything else, make a reel
no
of it.
No idea. No idea where it is.
Okay,
no
you got to go find that before it gets like shoved in the bottom of a tub somewhere.
Speaking of reels, you guys you and Bronwyn Birdsall have so inspired me. Have you had a flurry of people tagging?
Yes. Yeah, it's been super exciting. We were just messaging each other about it today. I think she's off doing bookshop visits. And she said it's so good that people have had a play and felt like, okay, I'm just going to try it. Like it doesn't have to be perfect. It's not going to be amazing.
If you go to Kate's Instagram page, one of the posts there is the live stream. So the captured live stream that she did with Bronwyn Birdsall, author of Time and Tide in Sarajevo. And Bronwyn is a digital marketing guru person.
Yeah.
So it's a bit like the Shay episode.
It is.
But it's really, really practical. So you should all practical. Go and watch.
And you should take up her challenge, which is to have a play with making a reel. You can check out Bronwyn Birdsall's Instagram where she's put down the details. And her challenge was really for people to just experiment with it. And she said, you know, use about 20 or 30 seconds, use this many images, use a combination of video and stills, and think about it as a story. And I've been playing with that today as I started to say, doing this artist statement from a workshop I did with Sarah Santillis very early in the morning on Monday. And it was a really excellent kind of additional tool to have in the toolkit for thinking about how the ideas and the different inspirations that I've used for the thinking about the book come together, like the music and the images. And it was just a fun way of using it as well. So, I truly encourage people to have a play with it.
Maybe you can do a reel as your dissertation.
Oh, my gosh. I am so thinking about using a reel in my next PhD thing. I'll get thrown out. For sure I'll get thrown out at some point. Can I ask, just going back to your middle grade novel, did you get all the words cut?
I cut all the words. I cut 12,000 words. I think I sent like 30 sample comics. I have way more, but they're really, like, it takes time to make, they're really rough looking. So I didn't want to invest the energy to.
Are you keeping them? Can we see any of them?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. They're pretty hard to decipher, but I understand them, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
I need to take them out of notey note form. But it feels like such a good moment sending stuff off, doesn't it? I always see people post about that on Twitter. And as it's a bit like on Twitter when you say you've got news and then don't say what the news is. Like it really doesn't translate.
No, it doesn't.
But I feel very happy.
Congratulations, my friend. I am so excited for you. So what does that mean that you're working on next? Because we have some days away next week.
I know, we do. I think I will. I've missed a couple of artists' dates. I had booked in a horse ride for one of my artist dates, but I didn't get there. So I might try and slip that in on the way to Musk. I ended up at an op shop, which felt like a real downgrade. I went to a few different op shops. Op shops are fun, but it wasn't.
Op shops are really fun. Horse ride on the way to Musk. That sounds amazing. Can I tell you about, I don't know if this classes is an artist date. I've actually taken some time out of Musk to go on a date. As part of my research to finally visit a meatworks because I haven't been able to during
like
COVID.
An abattoir.
Yeah.
Is that what do they call them now? Do they call them a meatworks?
Yeah, abattoir, meatworks, processing plant is often how it is referred to. Processing plant. Yes.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm
bearing in mind we're both meat eaters.
We are both meat eaters, and I've been researching and writing about this for 3 or 4 years now, and I have read a lot and seen a lot of footage. And of course, it was first on my list of things to do for my research, but COVID prevented that because of the limitation for people going into meatworks. So I'm nervous, but kind of excited about seeing everything at work.
Wow. Yeah.
So we're both having artist dates. Yours will probably be more enjoyable than mine.
Might be nicer than yours.
How hilarious that we were like, oh, we'll just do a quick one today because we don't have a lot of things to say and already we have so many things to say. I want to talk about something that is timely. In fact, when you're listening to this, if you're listening to it on the day it comes out on Monday, the 22nd of August, you only have until 11:45 p.m. this evening to deal with what I'm going to tell you about. The National Cultural Policy is asking for submissions. It's been asking for quite a while, but, you know, sometimes some of us only get to things right at the last minute. So you can put in a submission to say, you know, basically we need more money and more support and more funding. There's two really good resources that we'll link to in the show notes. The first is out from the Australian Society of Authors, the ASA, who I know many of our listeners will already be members of. It's got information on, and a sample as well of what you might put in your own submission. So you can kind of cut and paste because let's be honest, we all do enough unpaid labor as artists. So you might want to just cut and paste this one. And there's also a really great article from Jennifer Mills, the writer Jennifer Mills in Medium, which we'll link to as well. And she shows exactly the submission that she's put forward put into the National Cultural Policy. And as she says, you know, we all have consultation fatigue, but she chooses to believe that this is a genuine opportunity to make our voices heard. So we're sorry that we didn't tell everyone about it earlier, but even if you do have to or want to cut and paste and put your name to something, we'll put the direct link in how you can do that. Tick.
Great one. Also wanted to shout out and give a massive, massive thank you to a couple of new Patreons. They are Tim Maguire and Fiona Robertson. Thank you so much for supporting the show. That Patreon money goes towards paying all of our costs and, of course, our fabulous audio person, Phoebe 80.
Look at our smiley faces. Phoebe has already, I should have told you this, but via email has said yes. She signs on again for season 6. Next year, season 6, which is very exciting because we are in planning mode. We're actually at this point in our professionalization, should we call this? We are having a planning day, Catherine, rather than just throwing emails at each other.
It's funny you say about professionalization because we had an interaction about going on another podcast and hadn't worked out properly where it was on. I didn't even know it was on. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. I realized that the way of keeping track of things at work, like I have a system in place. I have had no system for the podcast and it has just hit unwieldy.
It needs
a system. It needs a notebook or a spreadsheet, something. I don't know.
Something else. There are some, if you just look in Google Drive, Catherine, you'll notice that there are some spreadsheets there.
I've never really had to use Google Drive. I look at the spread, but I'm not Yeah.
Oh God, we're coming apart.
This is ish. This is like, who would have thought you would have this one technological advantage over me?
But we need our listeners' help. So we're having a planning day where we're thinking about, you know, what do we do next? We've talked to some of these massive people on our wish list, and we obviously have an extensive wish list and we haven't yet ticked off all the people, but we want to know who our listeners want us to talk to as well.
Yeah. So tell us. Well, this episode will go up alongside a post that more formally asks for people to put in and provides an avenue to do that. But we would love to know who people are interested in hearing us talk to.
Who do you want to hear us talk to? And if, in particular, if there's genres, areas, you know, people that you feel like we've missed, like are we just, you know, not covering your particular area of obsession and love as much as we should, tell us that. Give us the names of people. You can get in contact with us via the website or on social media, on Instagram or Twitter. You know what will be even better? Tag the people that you want us to interview and tell us why you want to interview them. You know, all your flattery, and that potentially may help them get on our list. We're not promising anything, but we, you know, we want to appear to be consultative.
On the topic of people we are going to talk to, we have a featured book this episode.
We do. We are talking to James Mackenzie Watson about Denizen. Our featured book is debut novel Denizen by James Mackenzie Watson, and this segment is brought to you by Penguin. James Mackenzie Watson writes short and novel-length fiction with a focus on health and rural Australia. His novel Denizen was winner of the 2021 Penguin Literary Prize. James co-hosts the health and writing podcast, James and Ashley Stay at Home, and works as a nurse. Welcome, James, to the podcast.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
I was listening to you speak on your own podcast, James and Ashley Stay at Home, which we'll talk a little bit more about. But you mentioned that the genesis of Denizen is in a film you made when you were 15 years old. Can you tell us a bit about that and how the process, I suppose, of how that seed became the novel that we can now hold in our hands?
It's really interesting. My creative outlet when I was a teenager and a child was filmmaking. I was sure that was what I was going to do. And, you know, I got to about 16 and realised that if I ran out of Xbox games to bribe my younger brother into being in these films with, then, it, you know, it wasn't going to happen. And that was kind of what kept happening. He was like, I'm not doing this anymore. You're going to have to find someone else. We lived on a property a long way from anywhere else, so I didn't have anyone else. But a lot of the novels that I, the early manuscripts I wrote, I kind of tried to teach myself how to write novels in my early 20s by just writing novels, you know, in a corner in the dark without really showing them to people. And the first three or four manuscripts that I wrote were based on these films. And that's partly because they were ideas that I thought, you know, like there's some interesting stuff to explore here. But I think largely as well because I realize in retrospect that for me, writing at that point was very much therapy. It was, you know, a way to sort of be kind of unpacking things that I'd felt, seen, experienced as a kid and a teenager, a lot of which had sort of become unintentionally bound up in these films that I was making anyway, but also homesickness. You know, I'd left the bush, was living in Sydney as an adult and really missing the bush and that landscape and sort of immersing myself there by writing these stories set in those places. Denizen had its earliest origin in a film that I made when I was 15 called The Creek. And The Creek's about a group of teenagers who are camping in a remote creek bed on a property in Western New South Wales. Something goes horribly wrong. And that became the second act, what's now the second act of Denizen. When I originally wrote Denizen, this was back in 2015, I wrote the first draft and it was a very different novel. It took a very different shape back then. It was originally only two acts, what's now act two and three. And it was with years of redrafting that the first act was fleshed out. So it originally much more resembled The Creek than it does now in terms of that core narrative. But I think, you know, really there's not a whole lot of similarity other than that setting and that vague premise between The Creek and Denizen, because I realized as soon as I started writing Denizen that what I really wanted to explore was these themes of mental health in the bush, and the narrative in The Creek just became a really convenient vehicle to explore those things.
Let's talk about that. You've said that you wanted to write about mental health in particular in rural areas. And I wanted to ask how you went about balancing your feelings and what you wanted to say with writing this kind of cracking, plotty thriller. You know, were there times where you had to, I don't know, do another pass at it and kind of put another lens on or another head on when you were looking at it? Because as you said, it's some really weighty stuff. And some really big issues, but then you've got this kind of vessel of this thriller that's racing you through. How did you balance that?
I completely by accident is the entirely honest answer. I didn't realise that, you know, Denizen would be called a thriller until it was well into the marketing stage with Penguin. I think because when I wrote it, I was writing it for me. You know, I wrote it from a very selfish place of wanting to explore these things. It was very much modelled on David Vann's novels, who I you know, wax lyrical about in our podcast. David Vann's an American author who writes novels. They tend to be novels about a small group of people set over a short space in time where terrible things happen. They play out like Greek tragedies, where it's people having to deal with some kind of trauma or tragedy. He says that he writes for therapy. He writes to play out scenarios in his head to their, you know, to the nth, to their most natural logical conclusion. Mm-hmm. He had a pretty traumatic upbringing. His father killed himself when he was 13, and a lot of his novels, you can very clearly see him struggling with the ghosts of that past and struggling with his feelings about that and playing out often quite, you know, barely metaphorically, very thinly veiled scenarios around that. And I feel like without realising, you know, that that was how David Vann wrote, I was doing a lot of the same thing in writing. As I say, I wrote because it was cheaper than therapy. I wrote because there were things that I wanted to work through. And that's very kind of you to say that it reads at such a pace. As I said, that is entirely an accident. I feel like I've probably got Johannes Jakob, the editor at Penguin, who I worked with, to thank for that as much as anything. He did a fantastic job of, you know, helping increase that tension and ramp up that tension through the novel. To me, the backbone of the novel is very much in the emotional arc, which is, again, a byproduct of it being something that I wanted to work through. You know, everything I've ever written comes from a place of me feeling troubled by something or bothered by something or upset by something and wanting to process it and understand it, which I hope gives the things I write a very natural backbone because they've got that shape of, you know, trying to punch through that emotion. And so if Denizen does read quickly and excitingly, I hope it's because of that backbone of that emotional arc that's pulling the reader through.
It very much is. I wanted to ask, because you've obviously got a your other life, your non-writing life is in health and you work as a nurse. And this idea about the issues of mental health in rural Australia, it struck me as I was reading, I was reminded of Meg Mason's Sorrow and Bliss in that particular decision that she makes not to name the diagnosis in that book, which is a decision that you really make as well in this book. And I just wanted to ask, from your perspective in the health system, were there extra responsibilities or factors that you brought into your writing that you thought it's important that I write about this particular character and these experiences that are happening in this town in certain ways?
Very much so. But that didn't feel like that was born out of a sense of responsibility to the health system. That felt like that was more born out of a sense of responsibility to the bush and the communities in the country. And obviously there's a lot of overlap in those two things. And you're right, I was very conscious to not give, you know, what's happening in the novel any labels, because I feel like there's enough stigma around a lot of these conditions as it is without, you know, and hopefully if it's described well enough, people will understand what I am driving at without it needing to be be named and attached to it in that way. I think, I mean, something, as I said, definitely feel a sense of responsibility to the bush and to the country town that I grew up in, because I know that a lot of people that knew me as a kid and as a teenager will be reading this very firmly with the country town I grew up in mind. And that's certainly not intentional. This is not a book about the town that I grew up in. It's very much an amalgamation of a lot of experiences. I think, you know, to drive that point home, the things that happen in Denizen are things that I saw happen in a myriad of country towns across New South Wales and Australia. It doesn't have to be any one town, because these things are happening anywhere. You know, these kind of tragedies that result from the gap between, you know, the tension in the culture and the gap between how harsh the landscape is and how much everyone celebrates that, and then how stoic the people are. You know, this is something that's unique to to the country, not to any one town. Mm. But, you know, so hopefully that writing about it in that way is protective to any one place, because it is something that could happen anywhere. But at the same time, I think that it's really important that these things are talked about honestly and explicitly in order to hopefully shine a light on them and to promote some kind of conversation and some kind of empathy, which I guess in itself invariably is going to, you know, draw attention to places where things like this have happened. But certainly, you know, it wasn't my intention to illustrate any one place or any one thing, any one condition. And as I say, I think that the fact that these things happen everywhere all the time is hopefully reflective of that.
You've written two great pieces for both for Kill Your Darlings and Meanjin that, and I'll put them in the show notes, that talk about your journaling. Can you just share why you journal and how it's helped in both the writing and perhaps even in this place that you're in now of talking about the book as well?
I've always journaled. I've got journals from when I was 10 or 11, which are fascinating to go back through because they form such an incredible time capsule of who I was at that time. I journal for a whole bunch of reasons. I try to journal every day. I try to write a couple of hundred words every day. I do it on my phone. I wish I was one of those people who could do it longhand, but I just don't have the time or the patience for that. And I do it partly as a record, you know, partly because it's very helpful having access to that information when I need it, but largely because of the emotional processing that I get from it. I find that as a therapeutic practice, journaling allows you to step back and look at things, feelings, events, you know, with a bit of distance in a way that it's very easy to not do in the busyness of day-to-day life. You know, it's very easy to experience things and to then not really process them and not think about them. And I find that journaling really forces you to revisit things and think about them and process them a bit more, which I think is very helpful just from a personal level. You know, therapeutically, I find that incredibly helpful in terms of my mental health and my well-being. But it also, I think, from a writing perspective, provides this incredible trove of, you know, material to build upon and to pull apart. But also, you know, as I say, I know that so much of my writing turns on high emotion. It turns on people feeling very intensely and internal shifts. And tracking and tracing and unpicking my own emotion and emotional shifts, I feel like allows me to study and hopefully apply those things to my writing a bit better. I feel like hopefully in trying to really, really closely examine my internal state, that allows me to get better at writing the internal states of others and to identifying exactly where those shifts in emotion occurs and what makes a feeling so powerful and what, you know, what drives, as I say, that kind of high emotion in narrative. It's something that I advocate to everyone. I know it's difficult because it's so time consuming. That's a lot of people say they just don't have the time for it, which I completely understand. You know, I'm very lucky that I've built it so firmly into my routine that it's just something I do now. But I think especially for writers, it's such good practice for so many reasons. It's also really good for times like the last 3 months. I realized the other day that I think it's been about 2 months since I wrote anything, which is the longest I've gone in my entire life, I think. And that's bizarre because this is the time when my identity is as a writer more than it's ever been in my entire life. It's this weird paradox of I'm not actually doing any of the stuff that I love that kind of got me to this point. And journaling's a really lovely way to just stay in touch with that in a very small way, you know, for a couple of minutes every day. It just means that at least there's somewhere for that to go, you know, in the meantime while I'm waiting for the opportunity. Once all this is done and everyone's moved on to the next novel and everyone's forgotten about Denizen and I've got time to sit down and write again. Till then.
I want you to tell us about the why and the how of your podcast and what you've learned from making James and Ashley Stay at Home with Ashley Kalajin-Blunt.
So James and Ashley Stay at Home is, as I say at the start of every episode, it's a podcast about creativity, writing, and health. Ashley Kalajin-Blunt is a writer that you're obviously good friends with and very familiar with, Kate. She's one of my closest friends as well. I joined her writing group in 2017 when I was living in Sydney, which was also, I tell everyone this whenever this comes up, the absolute turning point in terms of my writing was joining that writing group and getting you know, that feedback and insight from other people. But that's a different story for a different day. Ashley and I bonded not only over our writing, but also over our health. So in the time that I knew Ashley, not long after I met Ashley, she was diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome after a year of really debilitating fatigue and illness. And about 18 months before we met, I'd been diagnosed with CIDP, which is an autoimmune neurological condition that about three people have ever heard of. So I won't go into it too much, but it's basically chronic Guillain-Barré syndrome. It's demyelination of peripheral nerves. So it results in weakness and numbness in lower legs, in limbs. But fatigue is a really big component of it as well. And so we kind of bonded over our various experiences with chronic health. I moved to Dubbo to work here as a nurse at the start of 2020, just as the pandemic was beginning. And we realized that all of a sudden when the pandemic hit and people were staying at home, that everyone else was kind of doing what we'd been doing for the last 3 years anyway, between our health and our writing. You know, writers tend to be a fairly introverted bunch. So between those two factors, everyone else was just catching up to what we'd already nailed. And so we thought, well, this is a fantastic opportunity to, you know, do what everyone else in the country was doing and start a podcast. But for us, talking about the intersection between writing and health and how the pandemic had really highlighted that. And so our idea was that we would interview writers from Australia and around the world, have conversations, particularly focus on writing and health, but also be able to talk about our own experiences with our health and our writing. And we are, I think we're 63 episodes in now, 2 years on, almost 2 years on. It's been such a fun and rewarding experience. I know Ashley feels the same. The thing that I have found the most incredibly fun and rewarding about it is the people we've met. It's been an incredible way to connect with other writers. And I don't mean that sort of in a businessy sense of, you know, connecting and making contacts, but I just mean in making friends, you know, making friendships, talking to people who have similar experiences and similar interests and doing similar things. I don't know how good an advice this is to other aspiring writers, but I think that in terms of the path to publication, starting the podcast with Ashley, when we did, you know, a year before I won the Penguin Literary Prize, was about the best thing I could have done, because it meant that once I won the Penguin Literary Prize and I was getting ready to be published and, you know, getting ready to promote the book, there were all these wonderful people in the industry that I'd already met and made friends with and were speaking to on a regular basis anyway, who were there to support me and help me along, and really have been such incredibly kind and such an incredibly kind and generous well of friendship in the last 2 months as the books come out. But I don't know if, as I say, I don't know if that's great advice to anyone who wants to be a writer, is make a podcast. That seems like a great time to waste a lot of time and not actually do any writing.
Tell me, have you got some advice for other writers who might be coming up behind you and looking at the kinds of experiences that you're having now or have had in the past year or so?
As I was saying a moment ago, the thing I tell everyone is join a writers group if you're not part of one already. I think that for me, that was the single most transformative thing I ever did for my writing. I kind of, as I said, been writing sort of in the dark for a couple of years before then, just working on novels, teaching myself how to write by writing novels, which I think in itself is a really good experience. You know, that's how you learn to do anything, is by practice. But it gets to a certain point when you need to have the insight and the feedback from other people in order to know how to craft it, how to help it find an audience. I think the thing that I didn't realize I'd get from joining a writer's group that was so beneficial was it gives you context for your work. It tells you sort of where it sits in relation to where other people at a similar point in your career are and where, you know, the local market is, and but also, you know, where your skill level's at, where your abilities are, what you need to be working on, what you're doing well, what you can improve on. And, you know, I found that I was so desperate to kind of soak up all this insight and advice from these really kind, generous, very skilled writers who were offering me this feedback. And I hope that that process of, you know, trying really hard to understand what they were saying and to apply it has helped me in being able to improve my writing, because, you know, it works the other way as well. In critiquing other people's writing, you learn how to critique your own writing better. Mm. It's skills that you just can't develop on your own.
James, have you got a debut recommendation for us? Anytime, any genre?
I've actually got two, which is because I thought of one and then I realised it's not technically a debut. The first one I was going to say was Australiana by Yumna Kassab, which Ashley and I interviewed Yumna for our podcast in April, I think. And it's a book that I think I would have got around to reading anyway, because it's so much in the vein of the kind of thing I love reading. But I'm so glad I did and was prompted to read it a bit earlier than I probably would have otherwise. So Yumna is a writer from Western Sydney. She's written this novel that explores rural Australian communities in a really interesting, experimental, unusual way. It's not quite a short story collection. It's not quite a novel. It's these chunks of writing that are linked together by theme and place. There are no persistent characters. There's no protagonist. And I love how she plays with form. You know, she makes the landscape the protagonist that drags you through the book. I've never read anything like it. Such a vivid sense of place and time. And as I said, it's not technically a debut because her true debut was a short story collection a couple of years earlier called The House of Yusuf, mm-hmm. Which does some similarly interesting things with form. But Australiana is absolutely fantastic, really interesting, really unusual, highly recommended. And the other one I was going to suggest is, which I probably don't need to, because I imagine that, you know, everyone you've interviewed in the last month has said the same thing, was Dirt Town by Hayley Scrivener. The same as everyone else. Thoroughly enjoyed Dirt Town. She doesn't really need another plug because I think everyone in the country has read it already.
What else have you got coming up that we can pop some links into the show notes for?
If you happen to be in Taree or Port Macquarie, I'm doing author talks there this coming weekend, August 26th and 27th, Taree on the 26th, Port Macquarie on the 27th.
Fantastic.
The week after, I'm in Southern Sydney for Writers Unleashed, which I'm so excited about. There's a whole bunch of wonderful, familiar faces coming along to that I can't wait to speak to. I'm talking to Hayley Scrivener about Rural Noir at 3 o'clock on the Saturday afternoon. And then the weekend after, I'll be at the Bad Sydney Crime Writers Festival at the State Library.
Congratulations to you and good luck for all your events.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
James's book, Denizen, was one of the books that I read in fast succession last week with Hayley Scrivener's Dirt Town.
Mm.
And excellent combo of books to read together. Have you read Dirt Town yet?
No, I've got it on my pile.
Oh my goodness. Like,
should I be reshuffling?
Just put some hours away because like you're gonna start. Yeah. And then you're just gonna go all the way through. Very good. And both of them, I think they are actually on panels together. And I want to see them talk. And maybe with Rick Morton and on the that new anthology about life in rural Australia, like him as well on that kind of panel. I want to see that. I want to see that and them all talking about it. Very good books. What have you been reading, Catherine? Any Maeve Binchy this week?
I have been reading Parasol Die by Jane Tuttle. So this is literary autofiction or memoir. Came out 2019. Jane is Australian born. She is an actor and writer, and she goes and lives in Paris. She's lived sort of on and off a bit, I think. But this particular book sort of picks up as she has gone over to study for 2 years. She gets a scholarship to do this acting studying thing. It is the most delightful read. I think I read it in a frenzy, really, but just a glorious Sunday afternoon, cozy read. It's just beautiful. Like, it's got a love story in it. It's got stuff about art and acting. It's about France and the city. The way that she writes about the cold, she's constantly cold in France. And I can remember going to Paris on my honeymoon with Carney and walking around, and we bought almond croissants from a patisserie and walked around eating them, which is a, you know, very much frowned upon thing in France anyway. But I remember being so, so cold, and just never in my life had I been so cold as I was walking around eating these croissants. Like, I should have put gloves on, really, but I was wanting to eat the food. And just hearing her write about the cold in France just took me back. It's a wonderful book. And the best bit about it, I actually went to write to the publisher saying, I know she's got another book coming. Can you send it out? And it's already on its way. So I feel like I'm going to do the same thing this weekend.
Perfect.
Settle in on a Sunday afternoon and read a Jane Tuttle book.
Settle in with Jane Tuttle. That sounds like a breakaway series. I love that. What have you been, any listening happening in your world at the moment?
Well, you gave me a great listening recommendation, which
Good.
Perhaps is on your list. It is an episode on the Goop on the Goop. On Goop, it is on your list, is it? Goop of Gwyneth Paltrow fame, and it's with Jane McGonigal.
Oh, my goodness. Tell me what you think, because I've been recommending this woman to everyone I know.
It's so good. So Jane McGonigal is described as a futurist. Well, that's mm-hmm. the work that she does. Her background is as a video game designer. And basically what her job is about is predicting or seeing trends mm-hmm. into the future. It sounds very psychic. It's not at all. It's more just noticing scientific. Things yeah. And yeah. getting a sense of where they're going. They use it to do scenario planning. So she incorporates this video game element. I think she worked with the World Bank.
Yeah. Large scale simulations.
And did a simulation of the pandemic before the pandemic came along. And that was a way for people to prepare for disasters. And so sort of also looks at how that can be useful. What did you think of it? I mean, you've been recommending it to everyone. I can't stop thinking about it.
I've been recommending it. So I listened to it. It blew my mind. Then I immediately bought the book and have been listening to her book, Imaginable, on the audiobook, which is incredible. Every time I recommend it, I say to people, and I will be buying the hard copy as well, because there's so many exercises mm-hmm. in there. There's kind of a workbook feel to it. So I can see how that would be useful to have the book. I also I'm a bit obsessed with Stephen Johnson, who is the thinker. He now does the TED interview podcast. He's a writer, and he's interviewed her for the TED interview podcast. Ooh, so I amazing. Listen to her on there as well. So I'm deep into this idea of imaginable, and there's so many correlations and connections for writers. Like, not only for specific writers who might be imagining into the future, but just this idea. I've been doing some exercises with her kind of flipped thinking. I'm such a fan. I really recommend that people also listen to the audiobook of Imaginable.
It's excellent. One exercise, for example, that she mentions in the Goop podcast is that this idea of thinking about how something is now and then just imagining 20 different ways that it could be different.
Yes. It's so good. And you know the other thing that I really think, and this goes to that time when I remember we recorded, or we weren't going to record, because you were in like full-blown climate anxiety. And I talked to, actually, I recorded our interview with Sophie Cunningham for the Master Series this week, and we talk a lot about climate anxiety. And what I love about Jane McGonigal's work is that she's like, yeah, it's shit. But it can be different, and we can think differently about it. And the act of starting to think differently about it is a positive, radical kind of way of moving into another possible future. So I found it, quite energizing.
Quite uplifting. And even her take on video games and kids playing video games, Gwyneth talks about her son being obsessed with video games, whereas Jane sort of says, well, there's a lot of problem solving in video games, and there's a lot of persistence and a lot of community and these kinds of things. Which I must say
is why our friend Shay of Bring the Salad fame recommended it to me in the first place. So I can't go around talking about it anymore without giving her a shout out for recommending it to me.
It's excellent. Other small listen is that you will not be interested in, but perhaps Shay would be interested in.
Oh, good.
Is the How to Fail podcast with Elizabeth Day. She interviews Carolyn Stanbury, Carolyn Stanbury is formerly of the Ladies of London reality show and is now on Real Housewives of Dubai. She is one of those utterly mesmerizing people. She's a really strong personality. She really, I think, genuinely doesn't care what people think about her. Is like nice as well, but that's probably not the first adjective that you think about when you see her. But she's just a compelling listen. Went to boarding school at the age of 6, hated it, was raised in a very sort of upper-class English environment. Yeah, fascinating listen. Cool. Carolyn Stanbury. Ladies of London.
Excellent. How do you line them up? I've been in kind of a frenzy of collecting things to listen to and read at the moment. And I'm like, I just need a better way of just having them all lined up for me in an app.
I don't have I don't have enough at the moment, I don't think. But I don't use, I didn't have an Apple phone for a long time, and now I've just gotten one for work, which is my main phone, and I have already dropped it.
After hassling the poor IT people.
I know, after hassling the poor. Anyway, I'm not going to take it back. I'm not going to. Anyway, the Apple podcasting app is the worst app I have ever experienced.
It is such a bad app.
It's so bad. I used one called Pocket Cast, which I think cost me $2 or something a lot of years ago.
Can you see what you've listened to?
Excellent.
I just want to be able to see what I listen to. Apple, why is that so hard? Or someone, if I'm looking in the wrong spot, someone please tell us. I want to say
it's a terrible app.
It's a terrible app. I want to say I had one of those beautiful kind of moments today when I was listening to On Being, randomly like picked someone from the On Being with Krista Tippett podcast and realized it was the same person who I had listened to and loved on the Between the Covers podcast, which is one I've recommended as well, the Crafting with Ursula series about science fiction in particular and Ursula Le Guin. So this person is Adrienne Marie Brown, who is a writer and thinker and activist, and she is amazing. It's blown my mind. So in her conversation with the Between the Covers podcast about Ursula Le Guin, she was looking at the correlation between social justice and science fiction and the idea of kind of organizing as a principle of science fiction and as a radical kind of act. And she talks about emergence theory, which is something that I hadn't really talked about. And she also talks about pleasure activism, which is something else that I'm going to dive deep into. So it was just one of those listens where I had to keep stopping to write things down. And I've gone now to the transcript of the episode to just go through it with a pencil and note down all of the things that I want to follow up on. So Adrienne Marie Brown on both those podcasts. Fabulous thinker and speaker and writer. Really uplifting as well, thinking about different ways the future might be different.
Bit of uplift.
There's good stuff out there.
What else you got?
Did you watch the tree show on the ABC?
No.
Okay. So it went off in the family WhatsApp, which is why I put it on last night for myself and one of the children. Australia's favourite tree. It's on the ABC. It has got as one of the presenters, two fabulous presenters. One of them is Paul West from River Cottage fame. And because he's talking about trees, got a bit of a lumberjack vibe, which, you know, is something that I quite enjoy. So there's that aspect of it. We'll just put that straight aside because really it is the most beautiful series. So they're basically, the premise is that they're trying to find Australia's favourite tree and there is a like species of tree and there's a panel of experts, including Costa and, you know, scientists and various people who are going to make that decision. Or maybe we get to vote. Not sure about that part. But beautifully filmed, beautiful information about these trees, and had the gorgeous sensation of being able to say to Etta as we were watching, oh, my gosh, I know people on this, because Sophie Cunningham is one of the people who's featured in the first episode. She's talking about River Red Gums, and it's just really beautiful. And considering that we talked about her book City of Trees this week when we had our conversation, and also David Lindenmeyer, who's an amazing scientist and writer and communicator, also happens to be the husband of our friend Karen Viggers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's a small world.
Really small world. So I've met him a couple of times and just he speaks so wonderfully and eloquently about the mountain ash and how we need to protect it. It's just a really, really beautiful series, one you can watch with the kids. The kids had great questions about it, so I highly recommend that.
I love that. I have no watching recommendations whatsoever.
Not even any.
Well, I think all the reality, like America is in its summer, so they're just, I mean, Housewives of Dubai is not a great show, but it's where we're at. I've got to, I'm going to watch The Trees.
Watch The Trees. It's really lovely. And
that sounds very wholesome.
It's very wholesome. And we are a wholesome podcast.
That's right.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.